Chapter 16, Traps. To Locke Erasmus at polnet.gov. From sandwater at arabnet.net. Re-invitation to a party. You don't want to miss this one. Kamal upstairs thinks he's the whole show. But when Shaw and Pack get started in the basement, that's when the fireworks start. I say, wait for the downstairs party before you pop any corks.
John Paul, said Teresa Wigan quietly, I don't understand what Peter's doing here. John Paul closed his suitcase. That's the way he likes it. We're supposed to be doing this secretly, but he asked us not to talk about it in here. John Paul put his finger to his lips, then picked up her suitcase as well as his and started on the long walk to the bunk room door. Teresa could do nothing but sigh and follow him. After all they'd been through with Peter, you'd think he could confide in them. But he still had to play these games where nobody knew everything that was going on but him. It was only a few hours since he had decided they were going to leave on the next shuttle, and supposedly they were supposed to keep it an absolute secret. So what does Peter do? Asks practically every member of the permanent station crew to do some favor for him, run some errand. And you've got to get it to me by 1800. They weren't idiots. They all knew that 1800 was when everyone going on the next flight had to board for a 1900 departure. So this great secret had been leaked, by implication, to everybody on the crew. And yet he still insisted that they not talk about it, and John Paul was going along with him. What kind of madness was this? Peter was clearly not being careless. He was too systematic for it to be an accident. Was he hoping to catch someone in the act of transmitting a warning to a shield? Well, what if, instead of a warning, they just blew up the shuttle? Maybe that was the operation, to sabotage whatever shuttle they were going home on. Did Peter think of that? Of course he did. It was in Peter's nature to think of everything. Or at least, it was in Peter's nature to think he had thought of everything. Out in the corridor, John Paul kept walking too quickly for her to converse with him, and when she tried anyway, he put his fingers to his lips. It's okay, he murmured. At the elevator to the hub of the station where the shuttles docked, D-Mac was waiting for them. He had to be there because their palms would not activate the elevator. I'm sorry we'll be losing you so soon, said D-Mac. You never did tell us, said John Paul, which bunk room was Dragon Army's. Oh, Ender never slept there anyway, said D-Mac. He had a private room. Commanders always did. Before that, he was in several armies, but too late now anyway, said John Paul. The elevator door opened. D-Mac stepped inside, held the door for them, palmed the controls, and entered the code for the right flight deck. Then he stepped back out of the elevator. Sorry I can't see you off, but Colonel... The minister suggested I shouldn't know about this. John Paul shrugged. The elevator doors closed, and they began their ascent. Johnny P., said Teresa. If we're so worried about being bugged, what was that about, talking so openly with him? He carries a damper, said John Paul. His conversations can't be listened to. Ours can, and this elevator is definitely bugged. What? Upanad told you that? It would be insane to set up security in a tube like this station without bugging the funnel through which everybody has to pass to get inside. Well, excuse me for not thinking like a paranoid spy. I think that's one of your best traits. She realized that she couldn't say anything she was thinking. And not just because it might be overheard by Upanat's security system. I hate it when you deal with me. Okay, what if I handle you instead, suggested John Paul, leering just a little. If you weren't carrying my bag for me, said Teresa, I'd tickle me. You aren't in on this any more than I am, said Teresa, but you act as if you know everything. Gravity had quickly faded, and now she was holding onto the side rail as she hooked her feet under the floor rail. I've guessed some things, said John Paul. For the rest, all I can do is trust. He really is a very smart boy.
Not as smart as he thinks, said Teresa. But a lot smarter than you think, said John Paul.
I suppose your evaluation of his intelligence is just right. Such a Goldilocks line makes me feel so ursine. Why can't you just say bear-like? Because I know the word ursine, and so do you, and it's fun to say.
The elevator doors opened.
Carry your bag for you, ma'am, said John Paul.
If you want, she said, but I'm not going to tip you.
Oh, you really are upset, he murmured.
She pulled herself past him as he started tossing bags to the orderlies. Peter was waiting at the shuttle entrance.
Cut it rather fine, didn't we? He said.
Is it 1800? Asked Teresa.
A minute before, said Peter.
Then we're early, said Teresa.
She sailed past him, too, and on into the airlock. Behind her, she could hear Peter saying, "What's got into her?" and John Paul answering, "Later." It took a moment to reorient herself once she was inside the shuttle. She couldn't shake the sensation that the floor was in the wrong place. Down was left and in was out, or some such thing. But she pulled herself by the handholds on the seat backs until she had found a seat, an aisle seat, to invite other passengers to sit somewhere else. But there were no other passengers, not even John Paul and Peter. After waiting a good 5 minutes, she became too impatient to sit there any longer. She found them standing in midair near the airlock, laughing about something.
"Are you laughing at me?" she asked, daring them to say yes.
"No," said Peter at once.
"Only a little," said John Paul. "We can talk now. The pilot has cut all the links to the station, and Peter's wearing a damper, too."
"How nice," said Teresa. "Too bad they didn't have one for me or your father to use."
"They didn't," said Peter. "I've got grafts. It's not like they keep them in stock."
"Why did you tell everybody you met here that we were leaving on this shuttle? Are you trying to get us killed?"
"Ah, what tangled webs we weave when we practice to deceive," said Peter.
"So, you're playing spider," said Teresa. "And what are we, threads or flies?"
"Passengers," said John Paul.
And Peter laughed.
"Let me in on the joke," said Teresa, "or I'll space you. I swear I will."
As soon as Graf knew he had an informer here at the station, he brought his own security team here. Unbeknownst to anyone but him, no messages are actually going into or out of the station, but it looks to anyone on the station as if they are.
"So you're hoping to catch someone sending a message about what shuttle we're on," said Teresa.
"Well, actually, we expect that no one will send a message at all."
"Then what is this for?" said Teresa.
"What matters is who doesn't send the message."
And Peter grinned at her.
"I won't ask anything more," said Teresa. "Since you're so smug about how clever you are, I suppose whatever your clever plan is, my dear clever boy thought it up."
"And people say Demosthenes has a sarcastic streak," said Peter.
A moment ago she didn't get it, and now she did. Something clicked, apparently. The right mental gear had shifted. The right synapse had sizzled with electricity for a moment.
"You wanted everybody to think they had accidentally discovered we were leaving, and gave them all a chance to send a message," said Teresa.
"Except one person. So if he's the one," John Paul finished her sentence, "then the message won't get sent."
"Unless he's really clever," said Teresa.
"Smarter than us," said Peter.
He and John Paul looked at each other. Then both of them shook their heads and said, "Nah," and then burst out laughing.
"I'm so glad you two are bonding so well," she said.
"Oh, Mom, don't be a butt about this," said Peter. I couldn't tell you, because if he knew it was a trap, it wouldn't work. And he's the one person who might be listening to everything. And for your information, I only just got the damper.
I understand all that, said Teresa. It's the fact that your father guessed it and I didn't.
Mom, said Peter, nobody thinks you're a lackwit, if that's what you're worried about.
Lackwit? In what musty drawer of some dead English professor's dust-covered desk did you find that word?
I assure you that never in my worst nightmares did I ever suppose that I was a lackwit.
Good, said Peter, because if you did, you'd be wrong.
Shouldn't we be strapping in for takeoff? Asked Teresa.
No, said Peter, we're not going anywhere.
Why not?
The station computers are busily running a simulation program saying that the shuttle is in its launch routine. Just to make it look right, we'll be cut loose and drift away from the station. As soon as the only people in the dock are Graf's team from outside, we'll come back and get out of this can. That seems a pretty elaborate shade to catch one informer.
You raised me with such a keen sense of style, Mom, said Peter. I can't overcome my childhood at your knee.
Lankovsky knocked at the door at nearly midnight. Petra had already been asleep for an hour. Bean logged off, disconnected his desk, and opened the door. Is there something wrong? He asked Lankovsky. Our mutual friend wishes to see the two of you.
Petra's already asleep, said Bean.
But he could see from the coldness of Lankovsky's demeanor that something was very wrong.
Is Alai all right?
He's very well, thank you, said Lankovsky. Please wake your wife, and bring her along as quickly as possible. 15 minutes later, adrenaline making sure that neither he nor Petra was the least bit groggy, they stood before Alai, not in the garden, but in an office. And Alai was sitting behind a desk. He had a single sheet of paper on the desk, and slid it across to Bean. Bean picked it up and read it.
You think I sent this, said Bean.
Or Petra did, said Alai. I tried to tell myself that perhaps you hadn't impressed upon her the importance of keeping this information from the hegemon. But then I realized that I was thinking like a very old-fashioned Muslim. She is responsible for her own actions. And she understood, as well as you did, that maintaining secrecy on this matter was vital.
Bean sighed. I didn't send it, said Bean. Petra didn't send it.
We not only understood your desire to keep this secret, we agreed with it. There is zero chance we would have sent information about what you're doing to anyone, period. And yet, here is this message, sent from our own net base, from this building.
Alai, said Bean, we're three of the smartest people on Earth. We've been through a war together, and the two of you survived Ashiel's kidnapping. And yet when something like this happens, you absolutely know that we're the ones who betrayed your trust. Who else from outside our circle knew this?
Well, let's see. All the men at that meeting have staffs. Their staffs are not made up of idiots. Even if no one explicitly told them, they'll see memos, they'll hear comments. Some of these men might even think it's not a breach of security to tell a deeply trusted aide, and a few of them might actually be only figureheads, so they have to tell the people who will be doing the real work or nothing will get done.
I know all these men, said Alai. Not as well as you know us, said Petra. Just because they're good Muslims and loyal to you doesn't mean they're all equally careful.
Peter has been building up a network of informants and correspondents since he was... Well, since he was a kid, long before any of them knew he was just a kid. It would be shocking if he didn't have an informant in your palace.
Alai sat staring at the paper on the desk. This is a very clumsy sort of disguise for the message, said Alai. I suppose you would have done a better job of it.
I would have encrypted it, said Bean. And Petra probably would have put it inside a graphic.
I think the very clumsiness of the message should tell you something, said Petra. The person who wrote this is someone who thinks he only needs to hide this information from somebody outside the inner circle. He would have to know that if you saw it, you'd recognize instantly that Shah refers to the old rulers of Iran, and Pak refers to Pakistan, while Kemal is a transparent reference to the founder of post-Ottoman Turkey. How could you not get it?
Alai nodded.
So he's only coding it like this to keep outsiders from understanding it, in case it gets intercepted by an enemy. He doesn't think anybody here would search his outgoing messages, said Petra. Whereas Bean and I know for a fact that we've been bugged since we got here. Not terribly successfully, said Alad with a tight little smile. Well, you need better snoopware to start with, said Bean. And if we had sent a message to Peter, said Petra, we would have told him explicitly to warn our Indian friend not to block the Chinese exit from India, only their return. We would have had no other reason to tell Peter about this at all, said Bean. We don't work for him. We don't really like him all that much. He's not, said Petra firmly, one of us. Eli nodded, sighed, leaned back in his chair. Please, sit down, he said. Thank you, said Petra. Bean walked to the window and looked out over lawns sprinkled by purified water from the Mediterranean. Where the favor of Allah was, the desert blossomed. I don't think there'll be any harm from this, said Bean, aside from our losing a bit of sleep tonight. You must see that it's hard for me to suspect my closest colleagues here. You're the Caliph, said Petra, but you're also still a very young man, and they see that. They know your plan is brilliant. They love you. They follow you and all the great things you plan for your people. But when you tell them, keep this an absolute secret, they say yes, they even mean it, but they don't take it really quite seriously because, you see, you're still a boy, said Eli. That will fade with time, said Petra. You have many years ahead of you. Eventually, all these older men will be replaced. By younger men that I trust even less, said Eli ruefully. Telling Peter is not the same thing as telling an enemy, said Bean. He shouldn't have had this information in advance of the invasion. But you notice that the informer didn't tell him when the invasion would start. Yes, he did, said Eli. Then I don't see it, said Bean. Petra got up again and looked at the printed-out email. The message doesn't say anything about the date of the invasion. It was sent, said Eli, on the day of the invasion. Bean and Petra looked at each other. Today? Said Bean. The Turkic campaign has already begun, said Eli, as soon as it was dark in Xinjiang. By now we have received confirmation via email messages that 3 airfields and a significant part of the power grid are in our hands. And so far, at least, there is no sign that the Chinese know anything is happening. It's going better than we could have hoped. It's begun, said Bean. So it was already too late to change the plans for the third front. No, it wasn't, said Eli. Our new orders have been sent. The Indonesian and Arab commanders are very proud to be entrusted with the mission that will take the war home to the enemy. Bean was appalled. But the logistics of it? There's no time to plan. Bean, said Eli with amusement, we already had the plans for a complicated beach landing. That was a logistical nightmare. Putting 300 separate forces ashore at different points on the Chinese coast, under cover of darkness 3 days from today, and supporting them with air raids and airdrops. My people can do that in their sleep. That was the best thing about your idea, Bean, my friend. It wasn't a plan at all. It was a situation, and the whole plan is for every individual commander to improvise ways to fulfill the mission objectives. I told them, in my orders, that as long as they keep moving inland, protect their men, and cause maximum annoyance to the Chinese government and military, they can't fail. It's begun, said Petra. Yes, said Bean. It's begun, and the shield is not in China. Petra looked at Bean and grinned. Let's see what we can do about keeping him away. More to the point, said Bean, since we have not given Peter the specific message he needs to convey to Virlomi in India, may we do so now, with your permission? Eli squinted at him. Tomorrow, after news of the fighting in Xinjiang has started to come out, I will tell you when.
In Upanad's office, Graf sat with his feet on the desk as Upanad worked at the security console. Well, sir, that's it, said Upanad. They're off. And they'll arrive when? Said Graf. I don't know, said Upanad. That's all about trajectories and very complicated equations balancing velocity, mass, speed. I wasn't the astrophysics teacher in battle school, you recall. You were small force tactics, if I remember, said Graf. And when you tried that experiment with military music, having the boys learn to sing together, Graf groaned. Please, don't remind me what a deeply stupid idea that was. But you saw that at once and let us mercifully drop the whole thing. Esprit de corps, my ass, said Graf. Upanad hit a group of keys on the console keyboard, and the screen showed that he had just logged off. All done here. I'm glad you found out about the informer here in Minkol. Having the Wiggins leave was the only safe option. Do you remember, said Graf, the time I accused you of letting Bean see your log on? Like yesterday, said Upanad. I don't think you were going to believe me until Dimak vouched for me and suggested Bean was crawling around the duct system and peeking through vents. Yes. Dimak was sure that you were so methodical you could not possibly have broken your habits in a moment of carelessness. He was right, wasn't he? Yes, said Upanad. I learned my lesson, said Graf. I trusted you ever since. I hope I have earned that trust many times over. I didn't keep all the faculty from battle school. Of course, there were some who thought the Ministry of Colonization too tame for their talents, but it isn't really a matter of personal loyalty, is it? What isn't, sir? Our loyalty should be to something larger than a particular person, don't you think? To a cause, perhaps. I'm loyal to the human race. That's a pretentious one, don't you think? But to a particular project. Spreading the human genome throughout as many star systems as possible, so our very existence can never be threatened again. And for that, I'd sacrifice many personal loyalties. It makes me completely predictable, but also someone unreliable, if you get what I mean. I think I do, sir. So my question, my good friend, is this. What are you loyal to? To this cause, sir, and to you. This informant who used your log on, did he peer at you through the vents again, do you think? Very unlikely, sir. I think it much more probable that he penetrated the system and chose me at random, sir. Yes, of course, but you must understand that because your name was on that email, we had to eliminate you as a possibility first. That is only logical, sir. So, as we sent the Wiggins home on the shuttle, we made sure that every member of the permanent staff found out that they were leaving, and had every opportunity to send a message, except you. Except me, sir? I have been with you continuously since they decided to go. That way, if a message was sent, even if it used your logon, we would know it wasn't you who sent it. But if a message wasn't sent, well, it was you who didn't send it. This is not likely to be foolproof, sir, said Upanad. Someone else might have not sent the message for reasons of his or her own, sir. It might be that their departure was not something for which a message was necessary. True, said Graf. But we would not convict you of a crime on the basis of a message not sent, merely assign you to a less critical responsibility, or give you the opportunity to resign with pension. That is very kind of you, sir. Please don't think of me as kind. The door opened. Upanad turned, obviously surprised. You can't come in here, he said to the Vietnamese woman who stood in the doorway. Oh, I invited her, said Graf. I don't think you know Colonel Nguyen of the IF Digital Security Force. No, said Upanad, rising to offer his hand. I didn't even know your office existed, per se. She ignored his hand and gave a paper to Graf. Oh, he said, not reading it yet. So we're in the clear in this room. The message did not use his logon, she said. Graf read the message. It consisted of a single word, off. The logon was that of one of the orderlies from the docks. The time in the message header showed it had been sent only a couple of minutes before. So my friend is in the clear, said Graf. No, sir, said Nguyen. Upanad, who had been looking relieved, now seemed baffled. But I did not send it. How could I? Nguyen did not answer him, but spoke only to Graf. It was sent from this console. She walked over to the console and started to log back on. Let me do that, said Upanad. She turned around, and there was a stun gun in her hand. "Stand against the wall," she said, "hands in plain view." Graf got up and opened the door. "Come on in," he said. Two more IF soldiers entered. "Please inspect Mr. Upanad for weapons or other lethal items. And under no circumstances is he to be allowed to touch a computer. We wouldn't want him to activate a program wiping out critical materials." "I don't know how this thing was done," said Upanad, "but you're wrong about me." Graf pointed to the console. "Nguyen is never wrong," he said. "She's even more methodical than you." Upanad watched. "She's signing on as me." And then, "She used my password. That's illegal." Nguyen called Graf over to look at the screen. "Normally, to log off, you press these two keys, you see, but he also pressed this one, with his little finger, so you wouldn't actually notice it had been pressed. That key sequence activated a resident program that sent the email using a random selection from among the staff identities. It also launched the ordinary log-off sequence, so to you, it looked like you had just watched someone log off in a perfectly normal way." "So, he had this ready to send at any time," said Graf. "But when he did send it, it was within 5 minutes of the actual launch." Graf and Nguyen turned around to look at Upanad. Graf could see in his eyes that he saw he had been caught. "So," said Graf, "how did Ashiel get to you? You've never met him, I don't think. Surely he didn't form some attachment with you when he was here for a few days as a student." "He has my family," said Upanad, and he burst into tears. "No, no," said Graf. "Control yourself. Act like a soldier. We have very little time here in which to correct your failure of judgment. Next time you'll know if someone comes to you with a threat like this, you come to me." "They said they'd know if I told you." "Then you would tell me that too," said Graf. "But now you have told me, so let's make this thing work to our advantage. What happens when you send this second message?" "I don't know," said Upanad. "It doesn't matter anyway. She just sent it again. When they get the same message twice, they'll know something is wrong." "Oh, they didn't get the message either time," said Graf. "We cut this console off. We cut the whole station from Earthside contact, just as the shuttle never actually left." The door opened yet again, and in came Peter, John Paul, and Teresa. Upanad turned his face to the wall. The soldiers would have turned him back around, but Graf gave them a gesture. "Let be." He knew how proud Upanad was. The shame in front of the people he had tried to betray was unbearable. Give him time to compose himself. Only when the Wiggins were sitting did Graf invite Upanad also to take a seat. He obeyed, hanging his head like a caricature of a whipped dog. "Sit up, Upanad, and face this like a man. These are good people. They understand that you did what you thought you must for your family. You were unwise not to trust me more, but even that is understandable." From Teresa's face, Graf could see that she, at least, was not half so understanding as he seemed to assume, but he won her silence with a gesture. "I'll tell you what," said Graf, "let's make this work to our advantage. I actually have a couple of shuttles at my disposal for this operation, compliments of Admiral Shamrajnagar, by the way. So the real quandary is deciding which of them to send when we actually allow your email to go out." "Two shuttles?" said Peter. "We have to make a guess about what Ashiel planned to do with this information. If he means to attack you upon landing, well, we have a very heavily armed shuttle that should be able to deal with anything he can throw against it from the ground or the air. I think what he's planning is probably a missile, as you're overflying some region where he can get a portable launch platform." "And your heavily armed shuttle can deal with that?" asked Peter. "Easily. The trouble is, this shuttle is not supposed to exist. The IF Charter specifically forbids any weaponization of atmospheric craft. It's designed to go along with colony ships in case the extermination of the Formics was not complete and we run into resistance. But if such a shuttle enters Earth's atmosphere and proves its capabilities by shooting down a missile, we could never tell anyone about it without compromising the IF. So, we could use this shuttle to get you safely to Earth, but we could never tell anyone about the attempt on your life." "I could live with that," said Peter. "Except that you don't actually have to get to Earth at this time." "No, I don't." "So we can send a different shuttle. Again, one whose existence is not known, but this time it is not illegal, because it hasn't been weaponized at all. In fact, while it's quite expensive compared to, say, a bazooka. It's very, very cheap compared with a real shuttle. This one's a dummy. It is carefully designed to match the velocity and radar signature of a real shuttle, but it lacks a few things, like any place to put a human being or any capability of a soft landing. So you send this one down, said Jean-Paul, draw their fire, and then have a propaganda field day. We'll have IF observers watching for the boost, and we'll be on that launch platform before it can be dismantled, or at least before the perpetrators can get away. Whether it ends up pointing to Achille or China, either way, we can demonstrate that someone on Earth fired at an IF shuttle. Puts them in a very bad position, said Peter. Do we announce that I was the target? We can decide that based on their response and on who is getting the blame. If it's China, I think we gain more by making it an attack on the international fleet. If it's Achille, we gain more by making him out to be an assassin. You seem to have been quite free about discussing these things in front of us, said Teresa. I suppose now you have to kill us. Just me, whispered Upanad. Well, I do have to fire you, said Graf, and I do have to send you back to Earth, because it just wouldn't do to have you stay on here. You'd just depress everyone else, slinking around, looking guilty and unworthy. Graf's tone was light enough to help keep Upanad from bursting into tears again. I've heard, Graf went on, that the Indian people need to have loyal men who fight for their freedom. That's the loyalty that transcends your loyalty to the Ministry of Colonization, and I understand it. So you must go where your loyalty leads you. This is unbelievable mercy, sir, said Upanad. It wasn't my idea, said Graf. My plan was to have you tried in secret by the IF and executed. But Peter told me that if you were guilty and it turned out you were protecting family members in Chinese custody, it would be wrong to punish you for the crime of imperfect loyalty. Upanad turned to look at Peter. My betrayal might have killed you and your family, but it didn't, said Peter. I like to think, said Graf, that God sometimes shows mercy to us by letting some accident prevent us from actually carrying out our worst plans. I don't believe that, said Teresa coldly. I believe if you point a gun at a man's head and the bullet was a dud, you're still a murderer in the eyes of God. Well then, said Graf, when we're all dead, if we find that we still exist in some form or other, we'll just have to ask God to tell us which of us is right. Chapter 17, Prophets. SecureSite.net. From lockerasmus@polnet.gov. Password, Suryawang. Re, girl on bridge. Reliable source begs, do not interfere with Chinese egress from India, but when they need to return or supply, block all possible routes. The Chinese thought at first that the incidents in Xinjiang province were the work of the insurgents who had been forming and reforming guerrilla groups for centuries. In the protocol-burdened Chinese army, it wasn't until late afternoon in Beijing that Hanzu was finally able to get enough information together to prove this was a major offensive originating outside China. For the 50th time since taking a place in the high command in Beijing, Hanzu despaired of getting anything done. It was always more important to show respect for one's superior's high status than to tell them the truth and make things happen. Even now, holding in his hands evidence of a level of training, discipline, coordination, and supply that made it impossible for these incidents in Xinjiang to be the work of local rebels, Hanzu had to wait hours for his request for a meeting to be processed through all the oh-so-important aides, flunkies, functionaries, and poobahs whose sole duty was to look as important and busy as possible while making sure that as little as possible actually got done. It was fully dark in Beijing when Hanzu crossed the square separating the strategy and planning section from the administrative section, another bit of mindlessly bad structure to separate these two sections by a long walk in the open air. They should have been across a low divider from each other, constantly shouting back and forth. Instead, strategy and planning were constantly making plans that administrative couldn't carry out, and administrative was constantly misunderstanding the purpose of plans and fighting against the very ideas that would make them effective. How did we ever conquer India, thought Hanzu. He kicked at the pigeons, scurrying around his feet. They fluttered a few meters away, then came back for more, as if they thought his feet might have shed something edible with each step. The only reason this government stays in power is that the people of China are pigeons. You can kick them, and they come back for more, and the worst of them are the bureaucrats. China invented bureaucracy, and with a 1,000-year head start on the rest of the world, they'd kept advancing the arts of obfuscation, kingdom-building, and tempests in teapots to a level unknown anywhere else. Byzantine bureaucracy was, by comparison, a forthright system. How did Achille do it? An outsider, a criminal, a madman. And all of this was well known to the Chinese government. Yet, he was able to cut through the layers of fawning backstabbers and get straight to the decision-making level. Most people didn't even know where the decision-making level was, since it was certainly not the famous leaders at the top, who were too old to think of anything new and too frightened of losing their perks or getting caught out in their decades of criminal acts ever to do anything but say, "Do as you think wise," to their underlings. It was two levels down that decisions were made, by aides to the top generals. It had taken Hansa 6 months to realize that a meeting with the top man was useless, because he would confer with his aides and follow their recommendations every time. Now he never bothered to meet with anyone else. But to set up such a meeting, of course, required that an elaborate request be made to each general, acknowledging that while the subject of the meeting was so vital it must be held immediately, it was so trivial that each general only needed to send his aide to the meeting in his place. Hansa was never sure whether all this elaborate charade was merely to show proper respect for tradition and form, or whether the generals actually were fooled by all this and made the decision each time whether to attend in person or send their aide. Of course, it was also possible that the general never saw the messages, and the aides made the decision for him. Most likely, though, his memo went to each general with a commentary. Noble and worthy general would be slighted if not in attendance, for instance, or tedious waste of heroic leader's time. Unworthy aide will be glad to take notes and report if anything important is said. Hansa had no loyalty to any of these buffoons. Whenever they made decisions on their own, they were hopelessly wrong. The ones that weren't completely bound by tradition were just as controlled by their own egos. Yet Hansa was completely loyal to China. He had always acted in China's best interest, and always would. The trouble was, he often defined China's best interest in a way that might easily get him shot. Like that message he sent to Bean and Petra, hoping they'd realize the danger to the hegemon if he really believed Hansa had been the source of his information. Sending such a bit of information was definitely treason, since Achille's adventure had been approved at the highest levels and therefore represented official Chinese policy. And yet, it would be a disaster for China's prestige and the world at large if it became known that China had sent an assassin to kill the hegemon. Nobody seemed to understand that sort of thing, mostly because they refused to see China as anything other than the center of the universe, around which all other nations orbited. What did it matter if China was regarded as a nation of tyrants and assassins? If someone doesn't like what China does, then that someone can go home and cry in his beer. But no nation was invincible, not even China. Hansa understood that, even if the others did not. It didn't help that the conquest of India had been so easy. Hansa had insisted on devising all sorts of contingency plans when things went wrong with a surprise attack on the Indian, Thai, and Vietnamese armies. But Achille's campaign of deception had been so successful, and the Thai strategy of defense had been so effective, that the Indians were fully committed, their supplies exhausted, and their morale at rock bottom when the Chinese armies began pouring across the borders, cutting the Indian army to pieces, and swallowing up each piece within days, sometimes within hours. All the glory went to Achille, of course, though it had been Hansa's careful planning with his staff of nearly 80 battle school graduates that put the Chinese armies exactly where they needed to be, at exactly the time they needed to be there. No, even though Hansa's team had written up the orders, they had actually been issued by administrative, and therefore it was administrative that won the medals, while strategy and planning got a single group commendation that had about the same effect on morale as if some lieutenant colonel had come in and said, "Nice try, boys. We know you meant well." Well, Ashiel was welcome to the glory because, in Hans's opinion, invading India had been pointless and self-defeating, not to mention evil. China did not have the resources to take on India's problems. When Indians governed India, the suffering people could only blame their fellow Indians. But now, when things went wrong, which they always did in India, it would all be blamed on the Chinese. The Chinese administrators who were sent in to govern India stayed surprisingly free of corruption, and they worked hard. But the fact is that no nation is governable except by overwhelming force or complete cooperation. And since there was no way conquering Chinese officials would get complete cooperation, and there was no hope of being able to pay for overwhelming force, the only question was when the resistance would become a problem. It became a problem not long after Ashiel left for the hegemony, when the Indians started piling up stones. Hansa had to hand it to them. When it came to truly annoying but symbolically powerful civil disobedience, the Indians were truly the daughters and sons of Gandhi. Even then, the bureaucrats hadn't listened to Hansa's advice and ended up getting themselves into a steadily worsening cycle of reprisals. So, it doesn't matter what the outside world thinks, right? We can do whatever we want because no one else has the power or the will to challenge us. Is that the story? What I have in my hands is the answer to that theory.
What does it mean that they've done nothing to acknowledge our offensive? Said Alai. Bean and Petra sat with him, looking at the holomap that showed every single objective in Xinjiang taken on schedule, as if the Chinese had been handed a script and were doing their part exactly as the Crescent League had asked them to. I think things are going very well, said Petra.
Ridiculously well, said Alai.
Well, don't be impatient, said Bean. Things move slowly in China, and they don't like making public pronouncements about their problems. Maybe they still see this as a group of local insurgents. Maybe they're waiting to announce what's going on until they can tell about their devastating counterattack.
That's just it, said Alai.
Our SAT intel says they're doing nothing. Even the nearest garrison troops are still in place.
The garrison commanders don't have the authority to send them into battle, said Bean.
Besides, they probably don't even know anything's wrong. Your forces have the land-based communications grid under control, right?
That was a secondary objective. That's what they're doing now, just to keep busy.
Petra began to laugh.
I get it, she said.
What's so funny? Asked Alai.
The public announcement, said Petra. You can't announce that a caliph has been named unanimously by all the Muslim nations.
We can announce it any time, said Alai, irritated.
But you're waiting until the Chinese make their announcement that some unknown nation has attacked them. Only when they've either admitted their ignorance or committed to some theory that's completely false do you come out and tell what's really happening, that the Muslim world is fully united under a caliph, and that you have taken responsibility for liberating the captive nations from the godless, imperialist Chinese.
You have to admit the story plays better that way, said Alai.
Absolutely, said Petra. I'm not laughing because you're wrong to do it that way. I'm simply laughing at the irony that you are so successful and the Chinese so completely unprepared that it's actually delaying your announcement.
But have patience, dear friend. Somebody in the Chinese high command knows what's happening, and eventually the rest of them will listen to him. And they'll mobilize their forces and make some kind of announcement.
They have to, said Bean, or the Russians will deliberately misunderstand their troop movements.
All right, said Alai.
But unfortunately, all the vids of my announcement were shot during daylight hours. It never crossed our minds that they would take this long to respond.
You know what, said Bean? No one will mind a bit if the vids are clearly pre-recorded, but even better would be for you to go on camera, live, to declare yourself and to announce what your armies are doing in Xinjiang.
The danger with doing it live is that I might let something slip, telling them that the Xinjiang invasion is not the main offensive.
Alai, you could announce outright that this was not the main offensive, and half the Chinese would think this was disinformation designed to keep their troops in India pinned down along the Pakistani border. In fact, I advise you to do that, because then you'll have a reputation as a truth-teller. It will make your later lies that much more effective. Alai laughed. You've eased my mind. You're suffering, said Petra, from the problem that plagues all the top commanders in this age of rapid communications. In the old days, Alexander and Caesar were right there on the field of battle. They could watch, issue orders, deal with things. They were needed. But you are stuck here in Damascus because here is where all the communications come together. If you're needed, you'll be needed here. So instead of having 1,000 things to keep your mind busy, you have all this adrenaline flowing and nowhere for it to go. I recommend pacing, said Bean. Do you play handball? Asked Petra. I get the picture, said Alai. Thank you. I'll be patient. And think about my advice, said Bean. To go on live and tell the truth. Your people will love you better if they see you as being so bold you can simply tell the enemy what you're going to do, and they can't stop you from doing it. Go away now, said Alai. You're repeating yourself. Laughing, Bean got up. So did Petra. I won't have time for you after this, you know, said Alai. They paused, turned. Once it's announced, once everybody knows, I'll have to start holding court, meeting people, judging disputes, showing myself to be the true caliph. Thank you for the time you've spent with us till now, said Petra. I hope we never have to oppose each other on the field of battle, said Bean, the way we've had to oppose Hansa in this war. Just remember, said Alai, Hansa's loyalties are divided. Mine are not. I'll remember that, said Bean. Salam, said Alai. Peace be in you. And in you, said Petra. Peace.
When the meeting ended, Hansa did not know whether his warning had been believed. Well, even if they didn't believe him now, in a few more hours they'd have no choice. The major force in the Xinjiang invasion would undoubtedly start their assault just before dawn tomorrow. Satellite intelligence would confirm what he'd told them today, but at the cost of 12 more hours of inaction. The most frustrating moment, however, had come near the end of the meeting when the senior aide to the senior general had asked, "So, if this is the beginning of a major offensive, what do you recommend?" "Send all available troops in the north. I would recommend 50% of all the garrison troops on the Russian border. Prepare them not only to deal with these horse-born guerrillas, but also with a major mechanized army that will probably invade tomorrow." "What about the concentration of troops in India?" asked the aide. "These are our best soldiers, the most highly trained, and the most mobile." "Leave them where they are," said Hansa. "But if we strip the garrisons along the Russian border, the Russians will attack." Another aide spoke up. "The Russians never fight well outside their own borders. Invade them, and they'll destroy you, but if they invade you, their soldiers won't fight." Hansa tried not to show his contempt for such ludicrous judgments. "The Russians will do what they do, and if they attack, we'll do what we need to do in response. However, you don't keep your troops from defending against the present enemy because they might be needed for a hypothetical enemy." All well and good, until the senior aide to the senior general said, "Very well. I will recommend the immediate removal of troops from India as quickly as possible to meet this current threat." "That's not what I meant," said Hansa. "But it is what I mean," said the aide. "I believe this is a Muslim offensive," said Hansa. "The enemy across the border in Pakistan is the same enemy attacking us in Xinjiang. They are certainly hoping we'll do exactly what you suggest, so their main offensive will have a better chance of success." The aide only laughed, and the others laughed with him. "You spent too many years out of China during your childhood, Hansa. India is a faraway place. What does it matter what happens there? We can take it again whenever we want, but these invaders in Xinjiang, they are inside China. The Russians are poised on the Chinese border. No matter what the enemy thinks, that is the real threat." "Why?" said Hansa, throwing caution to the winds as he directly challenged the senior aide. "Because foreign troops on Chinese soil would mean the present government has lost the mandate of heaven?" From around the table came the hiss of air suddenly gasped between clenched teeth. To refer to the old idea of the mandate of heaven was poisonously out of step with government policy. Well, As long as he was irritating people, why stop with that? Everyone knows that Xinjiang and Tibet are not part of Han China, said Hansa. They are no more important to us than India, conquests that have never become fully Chinese. We once owned Vietnam before, long ago, and lost it, and the loss meant nothing to us. But the Chinese army, that is precious, and if you take troops out of India, you run the grave risk of losing millions of our men to these Muslim fanatics. Then we won't have the mandate of heaven to worry about. We'll have foreign troops in Han China before we know it, and no way to defend against them. The silence around the table was deadly. They hated him now because he had spoken to them of defeat and told them disrespectfully that their ideas were wrong. I hope none of you will forget this meeting, said Hansa. You can be sure that we will not, said the senior aide. If I am wrong, then I will bear the consequences of my mistake and rejoice that your ideas were not stupid after all. What is good for China is good for me, even if I am punished for my mistakes. But if I am right, then we'll see what kind of men you are. Because if you're true Chinese, who love your country more than your careers, you'll remember that I was right, and you'll bring me back and listen to me as you should have listened to me today. But if you're the disloyal, selfish garden pigs I think you are, you'll make sure that I'm killed, so that no one outside this room will ever know that you heard a true warning and didn't listen to it when there was still time to save China from the most dangerous enemy we have faced since Genghis Khan. What a glorious speech, and how refreshing, actually, to say it with his lips to the people who most needed to hear it, instead of playing the speech over and over in his mind, ever more frustrated because not a word of it had been said aloud. Of course, he would be arrested tonight and quite possibly shot before morning, though the more likely pattern would be to arrest him and charge him with passing information to the enemy, blaming him for the defeat that only he actually tried to prevent. There was something about irony that had a special appeal to Chinese people who got a little power. There was a special pleasure in punishing a virtuous man for the powerful man's own crimes. But Hansa would not hide. It might be possible at this moment for him to leave China and go into exile, but he would not do it. Why not? He could not leave his country in its hour of need. Even though he might be killed for staying, there would be many other Chinese soldiers his age who would die in the next days and weeks. Why shouldn't he be one of them? And there was always the chance, however small and remote, that there were enough decent men among those at that meeting that Hansa would be kept alive until it was clear that he was right. Perhaps then, contrary to all expectation, they would bring him back and ask him how to save themselves from this disaster they had brought upon China. Meanwhile, Hansa was hungry, and there was a little restaurant he liked, where the manager and his wife treated him like one of the family. They did not care about his lofty rank or his status as one of the heroes of Ender's Jish. They liked him for his company. They loved the way he devoured their food as if it were the finest cuisine in the world, which to him it was. If these were his last hours of freedom, or even of life, why not spend them with people he liked, eating food he enjoyed?
As night fell in Damascus, Bean and Petra walked freely along the streets, looking into shop windows. Damascus still had the traditional markets, where most fresh food and local handwork were sold, but supermarkets, boutiques, and chain stores had reached Damascus, like almost every other place on earth. Only the wares for sale reflected local taste. There was no shortage of items of European and American design for sale, but what Bean and Petra enjoyed was the strangeness of items that would never find a market in the West, but which apparently were much in demand here. They traded guesses about what each item was for. They stopped at an outdoor restaurant with good music played softly enough that they could still converse. They had a strange combination of local food and international cuisine that had even the waiter shaking his head, but they were in the mood to please themselves. "I'll probably just throw it up tomorrow," said Petra. "Probably," said Bean. "But it'll be a better grade of please," said Petra. "I'm trying to eat."
"But you brought it up," said Bean.
"I know it's unfair, but when I discuss it, it doesn't make me sick. It's like tickling. You can't really nauseate yourself."
"I can,"
said Beam. I have no doubt of it. Probably one of the attributes of Anton's key. They continued talking about nothing much, until they heard some explosions, at first far away, then nearby. There can't possibly be an attack on Damascus, said Petra under her voice. No, I think it's fireworks, said Bean. I think it's a celebration. One of the cooks ran into the restaurant and shouted out a stream of Arabic, which was, of course, completely unintelligible to Bean and Petra. All at once, the local customers jumped up from the table. Some of them ran out of the restaurant without paying and nobody made to stop them. Others ran into the kitchen. The few non-Arabophones in the restaurant were left to wonder what was going on, until a merciful waiter came out and announced in common speech, "Food will be delay. I very sorry to tell you, but happy to say why. Caliph will speak in a minute." "The Caliph?" asked an Englishman. "Isn't he in Baghdad?" "I thought Istanbul," said a French woman. "There has been no Caliph in many centuries," said a professorial-looking Japanese. "Apparently they have one now," said Petra reasonably. "I wonder if they'll let us into the kitchen to watch with them." "Oh, I don't know if I want to," said the Englishman. "If they've got themselves a new caliph, they're going to be feeling quite chauvinistic for a while. What if they decide to start hanging foreigners to celebrate?" The Japanese scholar was outraged at this suggestion. While he and the Englishman politely went for each other's throats, Bean, Petra, the Frenchwoman, and several other Westerners went through the swinging door into the kitchen, where the kitchen help barely noticed they were there. Someone had brought a nice-sized flat vid in from one of the offices and set it on a shelf, leaning it against a wall. Alai was already on the screen. Not that it did them any good to watch. They couldn't understand a word of it. They'd have to wait for the full translation on one of the news nets later. But the map of Western China was pretty self-explanatory. No doubt he was telling them that the Muslim people had united to liberate long captive brothers in Xinjiang. The waiters and cooks punctuated almost every sentence with cheers. Lai seemed to know this would happen because he left pauses after each declaration. Unable to understand his words, Bean and Petra concentrated on other things. Bean tried to determine whether the speech was going out live. The clock on the wall was no indicator. Of course, they would insert it digitally into a pre-recorded vid during the broadcast, so that no matter when it was first aired, the clock would show the current time. Finally, he got his answer when Alai stood up and walked to the window. The camera followed him, and there, spread out below him, were the lights of Damascus, twinkling in the darkness. He was doing it live. And whatever he said while pointing to the city, it was apparently very effective, because at once the cheering cooks and waiters were weeping openly, without shame, their eyes still glued to the screen. Petra, meanwhile, was trying to guess how Alai must look to the Muslim people watching him. She knew his face so well, so that she had to try to separate the boy she had known from the man he now was. The compassion she had noticed before was more visible than ever. His eyes were full of love, but there was fire in him too, and dignity. He did not smile, which was proper for the leader of nations which were now at war, and whose sons were dying in combat and killing too. Nor did he rant, whipping them up into some kind of dangerous enthusiasm. Will these people follow him into battle? Yes, of course, at first, when he has a tale of easy victories to tell them. But later, when times are hard and fortune does not favor them, will they still follow him? Perhaps, yes. Because what Petra saw in him was not so much a great general, though yes, she could imagine Alexander might have looked like this, or Caesar, as a prophet king. Saul, or David, both young men when first called by prophecy to lead their people into war in God's name. Joan of Arc. Of course, Joan of Arc ended up dying at the stake, and Saul fell on his own sword. Or no, that was Brutus or Cassius. Saul commanded one of his own soldiers to kill him, didn't he? A bad end for both of them. and David died in disgrace, forbidden by God to build the holy temple because he had murdered Uriah to get Bathsheba into a state of marriageable widowhood. Not a good list of precedents, that. But they had their glory, didn't they? Before they fell.
Chapter 18, The War on the Ground. To Shamrajnagar, Jawaharla, at ifcom.gov. From Ancient Fire, Embers, at han.gov. Re-official statement coming. My esteemed friend and colleague, it grieves me that you would even suppose that in this time of trouble, when China is assailed by unprovoked assaults from religious fanatics, we would have either the desire or the resources to provoke the international fleet. We have nothing but the highest esteem for your institution, which so recently saved all humankind from the onslaught of star dragons. Our official statement, which will be released forthwith, does not include our speculations on who is in fact responsible for the tragic shooting down of the IF shuttle while it overflew Brazilian territory. While we do not admit to having any participation in or foreknowledge of the event, we have performed our own preliminary investigation, and we believe you will find that the equipment in question may in fact have originated with the Chinese military. This causes us excruciating embarrassment, and we beg you not to publicize this information. Instead, we provide you with the attached documentation showing that our one missile launcher, which is not accounted for, and which therefore may have been used to commit this crime, was released into the control of a certain Achille de Flandre, ostensibly for military operations in connection with our preemptive defensive action against the Indian aggressor as it ravaged Burma. We believed this materiel had been returned to us, but we discover upon investigation that it was not. Achille de Flandre at one time was under our protection, having rendered us a service in connection with forewarning us of the danger that India posed to peace in Southeast Asia. However, certain crimes he committed prior to this service came to our attention, and we arrested him. See documentation. As he was being conveyed to his place of re-education, unknown forces raided the convoy and released Achille de Flandre, killing all of the escorting soldiers. Since Achille de Flandre ended up almost immediately in the hegemony compound in Ribeirão Preto, Brazil, and he has been in a position to do much mischief there since the hasty departure of Peter Wiggin, and since the missile was fired from Brazilian territory and the shuttle was shot down over Brazil, we suggest that the place to look for responsibility for this attack on the IF is in Brazil, specifically the hegemony compound. Ultimate responsibility for all of de Flandre's actions after his abscondment from our custody must lie with those who took him, namely Hegemon Peter Wiggin and his military forces, headed by Julian Delfiki, and more recently the Thai national Suryawang, who is regarded by the Chinese government as a terrorist. I hope that this information provided to you off the record will prove useful to you in your investigation. If we can be of any other service that is not inconsistent with our desperate struggle for survival against the onslaught of the barbarian hordes from Asia, we will be glad to provide it. Your humble and unworthy colleague, Ancient Fire. From Shamrajnagar, Jawaharlal, at ifcom.gov. To Graf Pilgrimage, at colmin.gov. Re, who will take the blame? Dear Hiram, you see from the attached message from the esteemed head of the Chinese government that they have decided to offer up Achille as the sacrificial lamb. I think they'd be glad if we got rid of him for them. Our investigators will officially report that the launcher is of Chinese manufacture and has been traced back to Achille de Flandre without mentioning that it was originally provided to him by the Chinese government. When asked, we will refuse to speculate. That's the best they can hope for from us. Meanwhile, we now have the legal basis firmly established for an Earthside intervention, and from evidence provided by the nation most likely to complain about such an intervention. We will do nothing to affect the outcome or progress of the war in Asia. We will first seek the cooperation of the Brazilian government, but will make it clear that such cooperation is not required, legally or militarily. We will ask them to isolate the hegemony compound so that no one can get in or out, pending the arrival of our forces. I ask that you inform the hegemon and that you make your plans accordingly. Whether Mr. Wiggin should be present at the taking of the compound is a matter on which I have no opinion.
Verlomi never went into town herself. Those days were over. When she had been free to wander, a pilgrim in a land where people either lived their whole lives in one village or cut themselves loose and spent their whole lives on the road, she had loved coming to villages, each one an adventure, filled with its own tapestry of gossip, tragedy, humor, romance, and irony. In the college she had briefly attended, between coming home from space and being brought into Indian military headquarters in Hyderabad, she had quickly realized that intellectuals seemed to think that their life, the life of the mind, the endless self-examination, the continuous autobiography afflicted upon all comers, was somehow higher than the repetitive, meaningless lives of the common people. Verlomi knew the opposite to be true. The intellectuals in the university were all the same. They had precisely the same deep thoughts about exactly the same shallow emotions and trivial dilemmas. They knew this unconsciously themselves. When a real event happened, something that shook them to the heart, they withdrew from the game of university life, for reality had to be played out on a different stage. In the villages, life was about life, not about one-upmanship and display. Smart people were valued because they could solve problems, not because they could speak pleasingly about them. Everywhere she went in India, she constantly heard herself thinking, I could live here. I could stay among these people and marry one of these gentle peasant men and work beside him all my life. And then another part of her answered, no, you couldn't. Because like it or not, you are one of those university people after all. You can visit in the real world, but you don't belong there. You need to live in Plato's foolish dream, where ideas are real and reality is shadow. That is the place you were born for, and as you move from village to village, it is only to learn from them, to teach them, to manipulate them, to use them to achieve your own ends. But my own ends, she thought, are to give them gifts they need, wise government, or at least self-government. And then she laughed at herself, because the two were usually opposites. Even if an Indian ruled over Indians, it was not self-government, for the ruler governed the people, and the people governed the ruler. It was mutual government. That's the best that could be aspired to. Now, though, her pilgrim days were over. She had returned to the bridge, where the soldiers stationed to protect it and the nearby villagers had made a kind of god of her. She came back without fanfare, walking into the village that had taken her most to heart, and falling into conversation with women at the well and in the market. She went to the washing stream and lent a hand with the washing of clothes. Someone offered to share clothing with her so she could wash her dirty traveling rags, but she laughed and said that one more washing would rub them into dust, but she would like to earn some new clothing by helping a family that had a bit they could spare for her. Mistress, said one shy woman, did we not feed you at the bridge for nothing? So she was recognized. But I wish to earn the kindness you showed me there. You have blessed us many times, lady, said another. And now you bless us by coming among us and washing clothes. So she was still a god. I'm not what you think I am, she said. I am more terrible than your worst fear. To our enemies we pray, lady, said a woman. Terrible to them, indeed, said Verlomi. But I will use your sons and husbands to fight them, and some of them will die. Half our sons and husbands were already taken in the war against the Chinese. Killed in battle, lost and could not find their way home, carried off into captivity by the Chinese devils. Verlomi raised a hand to still them. I will not waste their lives if they obey me. You shouldn't go to war, lady, said one old crone. There's no good in it. Look at you, young, beautiful. Lie down with one of our young men, or one of our old ones if you want, and make babies. Someday, said Verlomi, I'll choose a husband and make babies with him, but today my husband is India, and he has been swallowed by a tiger. I must make the tiger sick, so he will throw my husband up. They giggled, some of them, at this image, but others were very grave. How will you do this? I will prepare the men so they don't die because of mistakes. I will assemble all the weapons we need, so no man is wasted because he is unarmed. I will bide my time, so we don't bring down the wrath of the tiger upon us until we're ready to hurt them so badly that they never recover from the blow. You didn't happen to bring a nuclear weapon with you, lady? Asked the crone, clearly something of an unbeliever. It's an offense against God to use such things, said Verlomi. The Muslim god was burned out of his house and turned his face against them because they used such weapons against each other. I was joking, said the crone, ashamed. I am not, said Verlomi. If you don't want me to use your men in the way I have described, tell me, and I'll go away and find another place that wants me. Perhaps your hatred of the Chinese is not so fierce as mine. Perhaps you are content with the way things are in this land. But they were not content, and their hatred was hot enough, it seemed. There wasn't much time for training, despite her promise, but then she wasn't going to use these men for firefights. They were to be saboteurs, thieves, demolition experts. They conspired with construction workers to steal explosives. They learned how to use them. They built dry storage pits in the jungles that clung to the steep hills. And they went to nearby towns and recruited more men, and then went farther and farther afield, building a network of saboteurs near every key bridge that could be blown up to block the Chinese from the use of the roads they would need to bring troops and supplies back and forth in and out of India. There could be no rehearsals, no dry runs. Nothing was done to arouse suspicion of any kind. She forbade her men to make any gestures of defiance or do anything to interfere with the smooth running of the Chinese transportation network through their hills and mountains. Some of them chafed at this, but Verlomi said, I gave my word to your wives and mothers that I would not waste your lives. There will be plenty of dying ahead, but only when your deaths will accomplish something so that those who live can bear witness. We did this thing. It was not done for us. Now she never went to town, but lived where she had lived before, in a cave near the bridge that she would blow up herself when the time came. But she could not afford to be cut off from the outside world. So three times a day, one of her people would sign on to the nets and check her dead drop sites, print out the messages there, and bring them to her. She made sure they knew how to wipe the information out of the computer's memory, so no one else could see what the computer had shown, and after she read the messages they brought, she burned them. She got Peter Wiggins' message in good time. So she was ready when her people started coming to her, running out of breath, excited. The war with the Turks is going badly for the Chinese, they said. We have it on the nets. The Turks have taken so many airfields that they can put more planes in the sky in Xinjiang than the Chinese can. They have dropped bombs on Beijing itself, lady. Then you should weep for the children who are dying there, said Verlomi. But the time for us to fight is not yet. And the next day, when the trucks began to rumble across the bridges and line up bumper to bumper along the narrow mountain roads, they begged her, let us blow up just one bridge, to show them that India is not sleeping while the Turks fight our enemy for us. She only answered them, why should we blow up bridges that our enemy is using to leave our land? But we could kill many if we timed the explosion just right. Even if we could kill 5,000 by blowing up all the bridges at exactly the right moment, they have 5 million. We will wait. Not one of you will do anything to warn them that they have enemies in these mountains. The time is soon, but you must wait for my word. Again and again she said it, all day long to everyone who came, and they obeyed. She sent them to telephone their comrades in faraway towns near other bridges, and they also obeyed. For 3 days, the Chinese-controlled news talked about how devastating armies were about to be brought to bear against the Turkic hordes, ready to punish them for their treachery. The traffic across the bridges and along the mountain roads was unrelenting. Then came the message she was waiting for. Now. No signature. But it was in a dead drop that she had given to Peter Wiggin. She knew that it meant
that the main offensive had been launched in the West, and the Chinese would soon begin sending troops and equipment back from China into India. She did not burn the message. She handed it to the child who had brought it to her and said, "Keep this forever. It is the beginning of our war." "Is it from Magad?" asked the child. "Perhaps the shadow of the nephew of a god," she answered with a smile. "Perhaps only a man in a dream of a sleeping god." Taking the child by the hand, she walked down into the village. The people swarmed around her. She smiled at them, patted the children's heads, hugged the women, and kissed them. Then she led this parade of citizens to the office of the local Chinese administrator and walked inside the building. Only a few of the women came with her. She walked right past the desk of the protesting officer on duty and into the office of the Chinese official who was on the telephone. He looked up at her and shouted, first in Chinese, then in common, "What are you doing? Get out of here!" But Verlomi paid no attention to his words. She walked up to him, smiling, reached out her arms as if to embrace him. He raised his hands in protest to fend her off with a gesture. She took his arms, pulled him off balance, and while he staggered to regain his footing, she flung her arms around him, gripped his head, and twisted it sharply. He fell dead to the floor. She opened a drawer in his desk, took out his pistol, and shot both of the Chinese soldiers who were rushing into the office. They, too, fell dead to the floor. She looked calmly at the women. "It is time. Please get on the telephones and call the others in every city. It is 1 hour till dark. At nightfall, they are to carry out their tasks with a short fuse. And if anyone tries to stop them, even if it's an Indian, they should kill them as quietly and quickly as possible and proceed with their work." They repeated the message to her, then set to work at the telephones. Verlomi went outside with the pistol hidden in the folds of her skirt. When the two other Chinese soldiers in the village came running, having heard the shots, she started jabbering to them in her native dialect. They did not realize that it was not the local language at all, but a completely unrelated tongue from the Dravidian south. They stopped, demanded that she tell them in common what had happened. She answered with a bullet into each man's belly before they even saw that she had a gun. Then she made sure of them with a bullet to each head as they lay on the ground. "Can you help me clean the street?" she asked the people who were gawking. At once they came out into the road and carried the bodies back inside the office. When the telephoning was done, she gathered them all at the door of the office. "When the Chinese authorities come and demand that you tell them what happened, you must tell them the truth. A man came walking down the road, an Indian man, but not from this village. He looked like a woman, and you thought he must be a god, because he walked right into this office and broke the neck of the magistrate. Then he took the magistrate's pistol and shot the two guards in the office, and then the two who came running up from the village. Not one of you had time to do anything but scream. Then this stranger made you carry the bodies of the dead soldiers into the office and then ordered you to leave while he made telephone calls. They will ask us to describe this man. Then describe me, dark, from the south of India. They will say, if he looked like a woman, how do you know she was not a woman? Because he killed a man with his bare hands. What woman can do that?" They laughed. "But you must not laugh," she said. "They will be very angry, and even if you do not give them any cause, they may punish you very harshly for what happened here. They may think you are lying and torture you to get you to tell the truth. And let me tell you right now, you are perfectly free to tell them that you think it may have been the same person who lived in that little cave near the bridge. You may lead them to that place." She turned to the child who had brought her Peter Wiggins' message. "Bury that paper in the ground until the war is over. It will still be there when you want it." She spoke to them all once more. "None of you did anything except carry the bodies of the dead to the places I told you to carry them. You would have told the authorities, but the only authorities you know are dead." She stretched out her arms. "Oh, my beloved people, I told you I would bring terrible days to you." She did not have to pretend to be sad, and her tears were real as she walked among them, touching hands, cheeks, shoulders one more time. Then she strode out along the road and out of the village. The men who were assigned to do it would blow up the nearby bridge an hour from now. She would not be there. She would be walking along paths in the woods, heading for the command post from which he would run this campaign of sabotage. For it would not be enough to blow up these bridges. They had to be ready to kill the engineers who would come to repair them, and kill the soldiers who would come to protect them, and then, when they brought enough soldiers and enough engineers that they could not be stopped from rebuilding the bridges, they would have to cause rockfalls and mudslides to block the narrow canyons. If they could seal this border for 3 days, the advancing Muslim armies would have time, if they were competently led, to break through and cut off the huge Chinese army that still faced them, so that the reinforcements, when they finally made it through, would be far, far too late. They too would be cut off in their turn.